continue with a very interesting talk, the Powerless Doctors Debate. And I would like to welcome now Dr. Sam White and Dr. Thomas Binder, and I would like to introduce them, and I will start with Dr. Sam White. He graduated from Cardiff University with a degree in medicine in 2004, and after completing GP training in 2010, Dr. Sam White worked as a partner in primary care. He would regularly teach undergraduate medical students from Southampton University. The weekends, he helped to run a palliative care hospice in Hampshire, looking after terminally ill patients, and he has since worked for several years in the local emergency department. Dr. White was also clinical supervisor of newly qualified doctors. He is a UK-based primary care physician focused on functional medicine. All along, Dr. White has asked questions about the handling of the COVID-19 pandemic. In early 2021, he resigned his position from practice since it became clear that the intention would be to recruit even younger patients, including children, into the vaccination experiment. As a result of speaking out, including a video published on social media of why he resigned as a GP partner, and publicly whistleblowing about what has been happening within the NHS, the National Health Service, Dr. White has been suspended from NHS and now faces a trial by the General Medical Council for spreading false information and misconduct. This could ultimately result in a loss of his license to practice medicine. However, he remains committed to his practice in functional and holistic medicine. So a warm welcome to you, Dr. White.
Thank you. Lovely to be here.
This is really great. I mean, let me start with a very basic question, which is why and how did you become involved in SARS-CoV-2 issues?
Well, to say I was involved is a difficult one. It was more that I was concerned about a narrative which was built upon PCR in the absence of proper clinical assessment, which I think is highly inappropriate. And we discussed already here tonight the indiscriminate use of PCR testing. At the same time, people were losing their businesses, their livelihoods, and all aspects of their life were being determined by this test, upon which they might not have any symptoms. And those who were poorly and becoming sick in the community, I was unable to help them in any way with safe, proven therapeutics. And it became clear from the UK government and the government advisors that the narrative and our only way out of this as a collective group of people of 65 million people was vaccination only. And then I simply went back, earlier last year and looked at what happened with the SARS-CoV-1 trials, which obviously didn't get beyond animal studies and for good reason. And that was enough for me in December when the UK first rolled out the Pfizer vaccine to say, there's no way I can offer my patients informed consent. I can't tell them what the risks or benefits are. But based on the previous SARS-CoV-1 experiment, it was enough for me to say then, I don't want any involvement. And then, as you rightly say, my thoughts were that the narrative changed to injecting more and more younger people who really weren't at risk of this disease, all the while withholding any treatments.
Dr. White, we will soon come to the question of the vaccines, but before we do that, you've been in practice, and I would really like to ask you, I mean, with COVID-19 presented as a probably deadly disease, and thus understandably spreading fear, well, sometimes even panic, one should assume that official institutions would accept merely any treatment, even if it had some minor side effects or was comparably expensive. Based on the experience in various countries, there are cheap and safe drugs, like, for instance, ivermectin, which have, if given correctly, major impact on the outcome of the disease. As UK, in addition, due to its colonies, has had vast experience with this, I mean, by definition, antiparasitic drug, was or is it used on a broad range in UK?
It's not commonly used here at all, and it's actually what's defined as a special order. So even if I was to put it on a non-NHS prescription as a private prescription for a patient, which I can't do any of that at the moment because I'm suspended, but even if I was, it would be incredibly expensive for a patient to purchase it of their own accord. So it could easily be made a lot cheaper if the health service decided to buy in bulk. And I think Dr. Laurie explained that it's around $3 per tablet, essentially. And of course, the dollar is very weak at the moment. So we're talking about a very cheap and inexpensive drug with decades of safety data compared with an entirely novel vaccine, which I loathe to call a vaccine, for which we have no medium and long-term safety data whatsoever.
Well, that's exactly the next point. I mean, UK was one of the first countries that rolled out a big vaccination campaign. I mean, it's widely known that the vaccines are all in phase three of the studies still. Thus, at the moment, they must be classified as experimental, which is also mirrored by the fact that they only got emergency use authorization only. How is the general vaccination strategy nowadays in the UK?
It would appear, according to the official sort of government reports, that the majority of adults in the UK are double vaccinated. And I've even recently seen adverts appearing for a booster shot in the autumn period, combined with the flu vaccine shot, for which I'm very fearful of the outcomes of that, given the potential for ADE, essentially antibody-dependent enhancement, that we've seen already, along with the four broadly categorized adverse reactions that we've seen, which are sort of hematological, immunological, neurological, and cardiac. And when we think about cardiac complications from these vaccines, we need to think about young adolescents, especially boys, who are developing myocarditis, sky-high elevated cardiac enzymes, along with corresponding ECG and echo changes. And when I chatted to Prof. McCulloch recently,
we have to stick to the time, and there have still some more questions to go. Based on what you said, based on the formal requirements, these products must not be applied as long as there is no informed consent. How is this handled in the UK?
Exactly. And that's why myself and my legal team have launched a legal challenge. And there's a crowdfunding site for people to donate to as well for that. And the principle of that is that informed consent is actually enshrined in law. And there cannot be informed consent for these vaccines whatsoever, because along with informed consent, where you might talk to someone about the risks and benefits, you also need to talk about what the alternatives are. And the alternatives might simply be not having a vaccine or not having any treatment. But any treatment should also include a discussion about therapeutics. And of course, we're not allowed to even talk about them. And that's why I'm in some hot water.
But you told us that so many people are vaccinated in the UK. Mm. Are these people informed in a proper way on indications and contraindications, probable severe side effects, the real effect of this? I don't call it vaccines, it's injections.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I would call it injections. And I've gone a bit further to say genetic manipulation in my video, which went viral. From the evidence testimony that we have of people who've gone through the process, no, it would seem that the full informed consent process has not been adhered to in a manner which would be in keeping with sort of good medical practice, essentially.
Dr. White, for the moment, thank you very much for your contributions. I hope you will join us in a few minutes in the final panel discussion. Thank you so much. And I want now to move on Dr. Thomas Binder. He studied medicine at the University of Zurich, Switzerland, with a main focus on immunology and virology, and then specialized in cardiology and internal medicine with now 32 years experience in diagnosis and treatment of acute respiratory illness, including in intensive care units. Since February 2020, he calls for a turn towards science, evidence-based medicine, and humanity. He dedicated a lot of his time to teach the public. As soon as he was aware of something went really wrong, he spoke out against political misconduct, for instance, by the phrase, "The test is the disease, not the virus." In contrast to his expectations that his fact-based critics in internet blogs, which, by the way, went viral, on tests, case fatality rates, the narratives like asymptomatic transmission and high numbers of so-called COVID patients on ICUs could have impact on political decisions, his house was searched by a Swiss anti-terror unit at Easter 2020 with some 60 policemen involved. He was locked up in a psychiatric unit for 6 days and forced to continue supervised psychiatric treatment since then. After posting an open letter to the EMA, his Twitter account was shut down with 46,000 followers, and his Facebook and LinkedIn accounts were shut as well. Dr. Binder, it's my honor and pleasure to have you here today. Thank you very much for joining us in this conference.
Thank you for your invitation, dear Martin.
How and why did you become involved in SARS-CoV-2 issues?
Well, I'm a practicing cardiologist and also a little bit internist for 23 years in Switzerland in my medical practice. And as a doctor, I mean, with a disease, with a new disease, you are involved from day one. And I looked at what is happening around me, and I couldn't understand. I asked from morning to night, what the heck is going on? I mean, everything in this whole narrative is unscientific and unmedical, and I had to forget everything I had learned in my medical life, which is 33 years now, to obey the orders of some corona experts, mainly biologists or laboratory physicians who never ever have seen, not to mention treated, any patient with a respiratory infection, and by journalists and politicians.
What was your personal reaction on the general official strategy in Switzerland? I mean, there was an official line, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, the official line in Switzerland is the same as almost globally. I mean, the whole narrative I explained from February, especially from March, I explained the whole pardon, corona nonsense narrative, and which is based on several myths. Myth one, that every doctor must have realized or should have realized is the wrong indication to test. Not only the very sick hospitalized patients, where we need to install specific antiviral treatment, so we must know the causative infection agent, and we only tested there for my whole life, but we also tested not very sick patients and later even asymptomatic, formerly called healthy people. So, I mean, every medical doctor should have realized this from day one. And I was sitting there speechless and wondered, where are my colleagues? And then I started to tweet this, to publish it in Facebook, in blogs and so on. And in one blog in the week before Easter, that had about 20,000 clicks in a day, I explained the whole narrative, wrong indication to test, wrong test, highly likely, no epidemiologically relevant asymptomatic transmission. CFR of 2% is nonsense because, of course, the IFR is important, the infection fatality rate, which is highly likely 100 times or so lower because of the great many undetected cases. In Switzerland, they said, oh, well, the virus is not that dangerous for the individual, but for the host society. And as it is spreading that rapidly, we will have many severely ill patients that need ICU treatment. And one of these panic orchestrators, a biologist who calls himself epidemiologist, said 5% of the patients will need ICU care. And for this, the Swiss government bought 1,000 new mechanical ventilators and non-emergency operations were postponed. It's nonsense from A, like asymptomatic infection, to C, like zero COVID in Switzerland, like everywhere.
I mean, we are talking now about the powerless doctors. And I already summed it up in my introduction, but let us go a little bit in detail. I mean, I already told you, and you confirmed it, that you had a quite strange encounter with the police after releasing this critical comment in the blog. What really happened to you in this situation?
Yeah, it's good that you asked me, because I must stress it was not the government who arrested me. I mean, initially, the whole thing started by intimate acquaintance. You know, I spread this information among my family members, friends, politicians, journalists I knew. And I thought, well, I don't know why me, simple doctor here in my medical practice in Switzerland, must enlighten the whole country. But, well, I did it. And then I thought, well, after 20,000 clicks, this information will spread, will go viral. And in a week or so, this whole narrative is gone, is destroyed. But, well, yes, some days later, on Easter Saturday, I did some final work in my medical practice, because on Easter Sunday, I wanted to go on holiday with my wife for a week or so. And in the evening, I was arrested by an anti-terrorist squad in my medical practice. And this intimate acquaintance of me, who got my information, a lawyer, not a doctor, a lawyer, thought, well, he understands more of corona diseases than me. And he thought, well, I must be insane. And obviously, these blocks he interpreted as a threat to governments and even family members. And he called the Prime Minister of Canton Aargau. This is the kind of the state in Switzerland, Canton Aargau, where I live. He called the Prime Minister, actually another quite intimate acquaintance of me. They both have my smartphone number on their smartphone. And they decided together, well, I must be totally insane and I am a threat to society, maybe to governments and family, so I must be arrested. And after I was arrested, they immediately found out, oh, well, there was absolutely no threat. The only threat was the threat of their worldview by my information. And they projected it in me. They projected their corona insanity in me. They didn't want to put me in jail, because they realized, oh, well, there was no threat. And they also said, I'm armed. I was armed. Well, my weapon was my Swiss Army gun I got in 1980 when I entered the Swiss military service. And after I left the army about 15 years ago, I kept it at home. That's usual in Switzerland. It may sound strange for some, but this is usual in Switzerland. But this was stored at home without any ammunition, That's absolutely legal and normal. So this was my terrorist armament that made them mobilize 60 anti-terrorist police officers.
But in addition to that, you were also locked up in psychiatry for roughly 1 week and ordered to continue psychiatric treatment. How was this justified?
As they found nothing unlawful in the jail, I was sent to a jail for some hours, and then an emergency doctor arrived, and she had to check my mental status. And this was an internist, And she also already in April 2020, she wore these hardcore FFP2 masks, was totally panicked by this virus. And she had to decide whether I'm corona insane or not. And she decided I would suffer from corona insanity. And well, because this is not enough for involuntary commitment. She then decided I'm self endangering. So with this diagnosis, she sent me into closed psychiatry. But I think this history nicely shows this context of delusion. It is the collision of two anti-universes, and there is no discourse between these two anti-universes. And in such a situation, we always have to question: am I really the realist, and is the other the deluded, or vice versa? And to answer this question, we must look as soberly as possible. We must look at the reality, at the scientific evidence. Yeah.
And
sorry, maybe I'm talking too much.
This was exactly what I wanted to get to, because I want just now to shift a little bit the focus. Because this is also some kind of maybe powerless doctor. I mean, there is another very interesting story that you were one of the scientists who reviewed the Cormann-Drosten paper on the PCR, which resulted in an initiative to have this paper retracted. I mean, this was powerless too, because I think the result was that it was not retracted. But what's your comment on that?
Well, I didn't feel powerless. I'm not the person who must have right. These people usually are in politics and so on. But if I am right, I fight for this. And especially here, I fight for science and medicine. And I mean, I always state from the Geneva Declaration of the World Medical Association the sentence: I will not use my medical knowledge to violate human rights and civil liberties, even under threat. And so I was not. I seemed powerless, but of course I augmented my power by networking. This is very important. I got a network in Switzerland and around the whole world. Doctors for COVID Ethics is a fantastic part of this network, and so there we got power. But of course, you mentioned the external peer review of the Cormann-Drosten report. There I was asked by the team around. Peter Borcher to participate. I'm not the PCR genius. We have geniuses like Ulrike Kemmerer, who already was a guest here today, or Kevin McKernan, who was a leading figure in the Human Genome Project. But my contribution was mainly in the addendum, again, to stress that not only the test is wrong, a PCR test is not per se a bad thing. I mean, if it's done properly, it's useful, but also in the clinical context, not as a test result alone. And especially to stress the wrong indication to test. Actually, this would be enough to destroy this whole narrative. And of course, I mean, after 3 months, the peer review of this, of the Cormann-Drosten paper, which was the recipe for this RT-PCR test for the laboratories, to develop this in the laboratories. I mean, the peer review there lasted about 24 hours. I mean, this has never seen before in medical history, I think. And the answer to our review report came after 3 months, and it was absolutely, it was a joke. I mean, they said, well, there were some minor issues, but it was really an emergency situation. But the emergency situation was, I guess, at this time when this paper, the Cormann-Drosten paper, was published, it was about January 23rd, I guess, 2020. I guess there were about 6 deaths worldwide. I mean, okay. even that you could have an idea that at this time this could become the pandemic of the century is highly suspicious.
Yeah, Dr. Binder, we're running out of time, and I still have one more partner. So at the moment, thank you very much, but please stay in this room, because we will have a little panel discussion afterwards. Thank you so much for being with us today. And now I move to our last speaker this evening. It's Dr. Charles Hoff. He has a rural family practice emergency medicine in British Columbia, Canada. He has been practicing in British Columbia for 28 years. He has experienced regulatory consequences after speaking and writing about vaccine dangers, and I assume he focuses with the expression vaccine on these injections we now give against SARS-CoV-2, including a letter to his provincial public health officer regarding vaccine-related harms he witnessed in his own patients. So a warm welcome to you, Dr. Hoff. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you.
May I also try to a little bit elaborate on your career and on your problems. I mean, the same question to you: how and why did you become involved in SARS-CoV-2 issues?
I became involved when evidence of serious injuries was appearing from around the world. I expressed my concerns about medical ethics because vaccines are not a medical treatment given to sick people. Vaccines are a medical treatment given to healthy people to keep them safe from disease. That's the idea. So when vaccines are injuring or killing healthy people, we should not be doing that. There should be a zero tolerance for doctors killing or injuring healthy people. And so I expressed the ethical concerns because the Hippocratic Oath says do no harm. And so that's the absolute bedrock of this, that I expressed my ethical concerns once there was evidence of harm that this experiment should be stopped. And I was reprimanded and told that I wasn't permitted to say anything negative about these experimental vaccines in our medical facility. And so, but I didn't. I complied with their orders, but I continued to speak publicly about it. And so the authorities were determined to find some grounds to suspend me. So on one occasion, I explained to an emergency room nurse that somebody who's had a natural COVID infection is completely immune to COVID and all of its variants and will have no benefit in any way from a vaccine because the vaccine doesn't give, firstly, your immunity is, your antibodies are in your blood. They're not in your respiratory tract, which is why vaccinated people still get COVID. Basically, the antibodies are in the wrong place and are not protecting them. But secondly, the antibodies are just to the spike protein, which means that it's a very narrow immunity that won't last long and won't cover all variants. Whereas immunity from natural infection is long lasting, is broad, and will cover every variant. So I explained that to a nurse, and on the basis of that, I was accused of telling people to not get vaccinated, and they suspended me.
Well, that's actually my next question. I mean, you took this critical position against COVID-19 measures in your country, Canada, which is a democratic country. So, in fact, what happened to you after speaking out? What was, you said you were suspended. How did this work? How was this possible?
Well, my suspension just meant that I couldn't work in any of the government health facilities anymore. So I had not lost my license to practice, so I could still work in a private practice. But I effectively lost 50% of my income straight off the bat by no longer being able to work as an emergency physician. And an investigation was launched by the College of Physicians and Surgeons of British Columbia against me. And they've issued a public decree that doctors are not allowed to contradict public health orders. And this is ethically also absurd because as doctors, we are trained to keep examining the evidence. You know, medicine and science are never settled. They are always a work in progress. We're supposed to constantly be re-examining new evidence to see if what we're doing is correct. That is how science works, and that is how evidence-based medicines work. But so we have now been told officially that we are not allowed to question public health orders. In other words, we have to follow the politics, not the science. So this is not just an abandonment of freedom of speech. It's an abandonment of science.
We see a phenomenon as compared to the past. Critical doctors nowadays, they run a high risk of being prosecuted, but mainly by their own colleagues or even the doctor's board. I mean, what is your explanation for that? Why is this happening?
Well, I think the mainline media, you know, the mainline media all receive government subsidies, and as a result, they have to toe the sort of party line, it appears to me, brainwashed the majority of people by just repeating the same lies over and over again. Eventually, people believe them. And there are many doctors, though, that realize that it doesn't make sense. But when they see to what happens to people like me, or what happened in the UK to Dr. White, they keep quiet. I'm not willing to keep quiet because I am passionate about truth and about science and about keeping people safe. And so if I see something that is doing clear harm, it is my duty as a doctor to stop that harm. And that is why I'm willing to put my career on the line in order to keep to the Hippocratic oath of do no harm.
But I mean, in contrast to all other medical topics, well, even to other vaccines, which are to be called vaccines, the hesitancy to promote and or to take these kind of injections, which based on the contents are not comparable with regular vaccines, is displayed. If it was a crime, would you share this perception?
Yes, that is the crime that I have been accused of, that I have caused vaccine hesitancy. And causing vaccine hesitancy, that is what has had me punished. That's what I lost half my income, and that's what's launched this investigation. So I now have a legal battle with the College of Physicians and Surgeons that would like to discipline me. So they haven't actually yet, but that's only because the investigation and my pushback against them is ongoing. And I will stand on medical ethics and science, even though, as I say, the majority of doctors, even if they can see the foolishness of this, won't speak up. But many of them have been brainwashed, just like the public, by watching television.
Just to nail this down, and this is now my last question to you. I mean, I think you already answered it, but I want to have it very clear also for the audience. I think the most important ethical pillar of medical doctors is their adherence to their oath. Primum nil nocere, which means primarily do no harm, don't do any harm. Do you see this principle violated by anti-COVID measures in general and COVID-19 immunizations in detail?
Yes, it is absurd, the violation of it. You know, before this, and I hesitate to call this a vaccine rollout because we've all agreed this is not a vaccine. It is genetic manipulation. It's gene therapy. But before this, if any vaccine worldwide killed between 30 and 50 people, even after giving more than 100 million doses, if it did that, it would literally be shut down. And that had been done with every other vaccine before. This so-called vaccine has now killed tens of thousands of people around the world. And very, very seriously injured others. I mean, in my medical practice, I have got 9 people disabled by the Moderna shot just in my medical practice, which is a small practice. So this is a complete abandonment of medical ethics because, you know, as I mentioned, These were not sick people being treated for some devastating disease. These are healthy people who took this shot in the belief that it would keep them safe. And it is absurd what it has done to them. This is an utter abandonment of medical ethics. And as Dr. White made an excellent point that, you know, medical ethics involves informed consent, you know, and firstly, you have to be told what the risks are. You need to be told what the benefits are. We don't even know what some of the risks even are because the trials haven't even finished. So people can't possibly have informed consent when even doctors don't know the full extent of the risks. I mean, we do not know for sure what this is going to do to fertility. Fertility studies take many years. We may not know for 10 years or maybe 15 years what happens to a baby in the uterus when the mother gets vaccinated. We have no idea.
Yeah, thank you very much for this statement. I mean, this conference will go on this evening and tomorrow evening, and vaccines will be one of the major topics which will be covered also. So at the moment, thank you very much for being with us. And I would ask Dr. Bind and Dr. White to unmute their microphones when they are speaking, to stay here with me to do some kind of a panel discussion. And I would ask the organizers and the technicians in the background to invite the other speakers to join us in our group now. We have still some 15 minutes to go because I've promised to finish this session on the point, which was not so easy due to the problems we had today. But anyhow, we will achieve that. And first of all, I would ask you, the three of you, whether one person of you has a question to one other who is now here, because I don't want to be the only one who asks questions here. Maybe it's also from your side.
I would like to ask Dr. Hoff, because we're all pretty much on the same page and had very similar experiences. I wonder if Dr. Hoff would mind sharing some of his preliminary evidence I heard him talk about regarding elevations in D-dimer levels immediately after vaccination.
Yes, certainly. So initially, when I sent my open letter to our provincial health officer, my primary, apart from questioning the ethics of this, the other question I asked is, what is the mechanism of injury for all of these injured patients, and how should I be treating them as their doctor? And of course, nobody knew what the mechanism was.
Was ist denn da los? Jetzt sind wir beim Wein hier.
Please stay out. We are here in the panel discussion still. May I ask the UK Column Studio to keep us on the broadcasting and to let the others out? They could join in by having their microphones muted. So please continue. Yeah, thank you.
Yes, so I was seeking a mechanism of injury. And so through my involvement with Doctors for COVID Ethics, and particularly through Professor Sukharat Bagdi, he explained how it was absolutely inevitable that these so-called vaccines would cause clotting, because firstly, the COVID spikes end up in the blood, and the nanoparticles are absorbed into the vascular endothelium. And so the vascular endothelium is going to end up covered with spike proteins, because that's where these little capsules of messenger RNA are absorbed. And so I set out to then investigate that theory by doing a blood test called a D-dimer, which is a blood test that detects blood clots. It detects recent blood clots. And so the test has to be done between 4 and 7 days after the injection to see whether clotting had occurred. Because it seemed to me that the blood clots that were occurring in my patients were most likely microvascular, which meant they were very small, too small to be detected on any CT scan or MRI or any medical imaging. They were too small and too scattered. And this made sense, because we know these things get absorbed into the capillary networks in very small vessels. So I then managed to find a group of people in my practice who had had their injection the week before. And in some, I was able to get them to do a blood test even before their injection to get a baseline. But in some of them, I was just only able to catch them because I didn't know who was getting these shots. It's not, I haven't been involved in giving them to them. Anyway, the bottom line is I found approximately 62% of people have an elevated D-dimer test, which means that 62% of people are getting microvascular blood clots directly following this shot. So the alarming part about this is that these people had no idea that they had blood clots, because these blood clots are so scattered and so small. Their symptoms were very nonspecific. But if you think of some of the frequent side effects from the shot, people often get headache, they get fatigue, they get nausea, they get dizziness. All of those would be symptoms of tiny blood clots in your brain.
May I just take the opportunity? I mean, when we are now in a panel and here are three doctors who are very experienced in the practical work out, and may I ask all of you just maybe a brief comment on that? The question is, do you think that your colleagues are aware of this problem, that it is now widespread enough so that if there are any symptoms like that, that they will go to do D-dimer tests on their patients? First of all, please, Dr. White.
No, I don't think there was a widespread awareness of the function of the spike protein and its implications for binding to ACE2 receptors. But the other thing is, I suspect it would be very difficult on the National Health Service, to obtain a D-dimer without clinical signs and symptoms. Okay, so you typically do need to put in, for instance, a Wells score, as commonly indicated in your clinical assessment. So in an NHS setting, I suspect you'd be liable to disciplinary action if you put on your request form post-vaccination study or post-vaccination query elevated D-dimer. That would be considered highly questionable and likely to end you up in the same situation I'm in now, actually. So well done, Dr. Hoff, for actually doing those tests and within such a short time frame after vaccination. And to have the data beforehand is really useful as well as a baseline.
Okay. And Dr. Binder in Switzerland, what would you say? Are colleagues aware of this problem, and do they run the D-dimer test?
I'm afraid they are not aware at all. I mean, they are not even aware that the vaccines are unnecessary, ineffective, and unsafe in general. I mean, their registration was already unscientific, unmedical, and unlawful. I mean, the absolute risk reduction was below 1%, and for minor disease, not for severe cases. The vaccines are unnecessary because the IFR is 0.15. If you replace the number of deceased within 28 days after a Gorman-Drosten nonsense RT-PCR test by the number of deceased from COVID-19, it is much lower. It is below that of influenza. That is dangerous for some people, of course, and it is unsafe. We know also for a long time. I mean, it's insane. We wrote an open letter to the Swiss Medic. This is the Swiss regulator for drugs and vaccines. So the equivalent to the EMA in the EU, where we wanted them to immediately retract those unnecessary, yeah, ineffective, unsafe vaccines. And yes, we are now currently working to sue them. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But you see, I want just to get a little bit of overview. Dr. Hoff, what's your opinion? Are your colleagues aware of this maybe silent clotting, and that it's important to do this D-dimer test in the period you mentioned? Do your colleagues?
No, they're not aware. Yeah, no, they are not aware at all. And so, I mean, I've done some interviews where I've tried to make people aware of that, and I've been informed by people who've sent me emails saying that they had gone to their doctor asking for this test, and the doctor had refused to do it. And part of the reason why the doctor refuses to do it that I've been given is that the doctor says, well, if it turns out to be positive, what are they going to do about it? And so they don't want to be left with that problem. So they would rather not test in case it's positive, and now they've got to decide how to treat this patient with blood clots.
You see, the reason why I asked is because I, on the one hand, I know that Professor Bhakti, this is one of his main issues, to detect those clotting problems as early as possible. And this is one of the, maybe for me, actually, that's the main point of the whole session we now had, that we have to spread this kind of information to others, that it's important to do this kind of test and to detect this kind of clotting problems. And the other thing is, this is at least my experience. People go for the vaccinations and they don't ask me. But when they get problems, they will ring me up and they will ask me what to do. And so in this, this was also one of the reasons that even if you don't give the vaccines and if you are against the vaccines, I think we should offer to the patients something that could make somehow to make them sure whether they are safe or not safe and whether their symptoms are somehow, I would say, attributable to the vaccine we had. So we did actually this panel discussion, the three of us with me. So I want to thank you. But as the final step, we have 3 minutes to go. I would ask each of you whether you do have something like a take-home message. And I start again with Dr. White. Do you have a take-home message for the audience?
I tend to prefer to put a positive spin on it, in that we actually are dealing with a very treatable illness. We just need to continue with our work to raise awareness of proven safe therapeutics that should be widely available in preference to these so-called vaccines. Another concern I have, which we haven't discussed, is that people are given these vaccines routinely and recommended for everyone, regardless of their previous medical history. So, for instance, someone who has a clotting disorder, factor V Leiden, for instance, it should never be given to someone like that, knowing what we know now and knowing even what we knew before. And so there just doesn't seem to be a full assessment of the patient in front of, you know, the vaccinator, if you like, of the risks pertaining to that particular patient.
Okay, thank you very much. Dr. Binder, your take-home message?
The primary responsibility is with our doctor, us doctors. We must remember the Hippocratic Oath and the Geneva Declaration of the World Medical Association. And if you follow these orders, we have to stop this nonsense now. We have to stop to give these experimental mRNA and DNA injections. And we have to end this whole corona nonsense narrative now. And because if we doctors stop it, it breaks down. I mean, who does vaccinate? Who treats the patients, whether they are suffering from SARS-CoV-2, of side effects of these experimental injections, or whatever? It is our responsibility as doctors. Please, colleagues, it is never too late. Everybody of us was deluded. We do not need to apologize for this. Everybody was deluded once. Our guilt becomes from the very moment where we are informed and we continue to be part of this crime against humanity.
Thank you so much. Dr. Hoff, your take-home message?
Yes, my take-home message is that the media have really succeeded in terrifying people about COVID. And what people really need to realize that the majority, that the reason why the vast majority of people do not get seriously sick from COVID is they're actually already immune to it from exposure to the other coronaviruses. And the fact that this push for vaccinating everybody, regardless of whether or not they have any immunity to it through natural infection with COVID or from the other coronaviruses, is absurd. They are completely ignoring natural immunity. But the other thing that is crucial to remember is that when this pandemic started, the public health policy was based on the fact that this is an untreatable disease, and therefore the vaccine is the only, your only route to safety. COVID-19 has turned out to be one of the most easily treatable viruses. It is fantastically easily treatable. And the fact that the authorities have actively suppressed that, the fact that they have refused to offer outpatient treatment for COVID, is an absolute abandonment of medical ethics. To tell people who have a potentially life-threatening thing to go home and do nothing until they turn blue is absolutely irresponsible. That is not medical treatment. There are brilliant treatments, and people need to find out about those. The one to start with is vitamin D, but there's a multitude of them. They're very safe. There's lots of science behind them, and the vaccine is not the only alternative.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much indeed. I want to thank you three now. I want to thank all the other speakers who joined us in this session, the first session of the conference. I want to thank Doctors for COVID Ethics for facilitating this conference, and especially Professor Sukharit Bhakti, who was responsible for the program. I want to thank UK Column for broadcasting this. And I want now to shift on and to ask Katharina Austin-Fitz and Taylor Hudak to continue with the second session. Thank you very much indeed, also to you, to the audience, and bye-bye. Stay safe.